Calling case number A20-1010, State versus White.
Thank you for appearing in our Zoom platform for this Court of Appeals argument. I want to remind you that all rules are applicable, except that you do not have to stand when making your argument. Please keep your microphone muted, except when it's your turn to speak. Also, I want to remind you to introduce yourself and indicate which party you're speaking on behalf of for recording purposes before the argument. With all of that said, appellant counsel, Mr. Cascanaro, when you're ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you. Good morning, Justices. My name is opposing counsel. Good morning. My name is Craig Cascarano. I represent Mr. White as the appellant in this matter. The issue before the court is whether or not the conditions that were imposed by the trial court at the time of sentencing, for the lack of any better term, are either collateral or direct consequences. Before I start, I want to clarify one thing. I have cited the Alanis case, A-L-A-N-I-S versus State at 583 Northwest 2nd, 573-577. It's a Minnesota Supreme Court case. And the judge, trial court judge, indicated that I had represented that there was a statement in there that probation conditions are a direct consequence. If I was inartful in my citing on that, that was not my intention. That was not the holding of that case. But that case was a Supreme Court case that talked about direct versus collateral consequences. So I wanted to make that clear before I started. I certainly didn't want to misrepresent anything to this court, and it was certainly not my intention to do that in my brief. We filed a motion to withdraw the plea. I concede it should have probably been filed as a petition for post-conviction relief, but the trial court regarded it as that. What I think is important in this case is two things. Number one, the trial court attorney filed an affidavit in support of the motion indicating that he did not tell Mr. White the what I have called draconian and onerous conditions of probation that are numbers 10 through 21. We are not, and I am not, suggesting to the court that Mr. White's plea was not voluntary. He understood that it certainly was accurate. The only issue was it intelligent, to wit, whether or not he understood the consequences of what was going to happen.
Can I inquire, anytime I see the phrase draconian, of course, reminds me of the Athens legislator Draco, and we see it mostly in the legislative political world, seldom, at least good thing, it's more seldom in the judicial world where such a phrase is used. I'm assuming, though, you're referring to at least some of the special conditions in particular. I couldn't glean from the brief specifically, but my question is this, and this is perhaps even beyond the law, because it sounds like you're agreeing your client doesn't need to be told of collateral consequences. The issue is whether they are or not. If they are or not, then of course must be told of them. And I'm looking at these special conditions, and the court did make some findings in addition to that it was collateral, but made specific findings related to why they were related. So for instance, the cell phones, there was evidence, as I understand, of a number of broken cell phones and the bloody hand in his car. There was some ambivalence about explaining his tax income situation. And one of the conditions is to file a tax return, which obviously I assume is not too onerous since one must comply with that, but there was also disclosure. What I'm trying to, I guess, ask you, is there a particular condition or conditions that you think is so on its face onerous that therefore it's no longer collateral? Is there one in particular or two?
Let me start by saying, Judge, that's exactly the issue, is are there certain conditions? As a general rule, I think the average and ordinary conditions of probation, I would concede, are collateral consequences. I think that's the case law. The direct consequences, of course, have been defined not only in the Atlanta case, but other case law by this court, as penalty, custodial penalty, for example, and fine. This particular case, first and foremost, I want to point out to the court that in the trial court's memorandum, the court presumed that Mr. White did not know of these, what I call special conditions of probation, items 10 through 21. I'm not disputing, Your Honor, that filing income tax is a direct consequence. He should have done that. He indicated to probation he didn't. With the consequences, though, of this probationary conditions, keep in mind that this was an Alford plea. So in an Alford plea, I'm not entirely convinced that some of his representations to the probation office would not be at least expected on an Alford plea. But when we go through all of these things, first and foremost, item number 10, provide probation current work, school, home, and cell service to probation. Okay, maybe that's not so bad. Can't have any more than two cell phones. I don't know why that's such a big deal. Provide accounting of electronic communication devices. I don't even know what that means, accounting of electronic communication devices. He can't buy a home. He has to provide all banking records. He has to even report his monthly income on a monthly basis and report what kind of cars he is purchasing. Providing passwords as requested, I don't think that's necessarily onerous. I think that's expected. Some of these things in 10 through 21, I think all of us could conclude, I would suggest that given the nature of the allegations and the fact that he pled guilty to promoting prostitution, some of them clearly would be, for lack of any better term, maybe expected. But banking records, install monitoring devices on software devices. I don't think that's all that big a deal. But the intrusion into this gentleman's privacy with regard to, you can't have any more than two cell phones. You have to provide banking records. You have to let us know how much you make a month. You have to let us know when you buy a car and if we're going to allow you to buy a car. I've been a criminal lawyer for 46 years. I can candidly tell the court I have never had any probation indicate those three conditions on any case. I know that's outside the record, but I think the bottom line is, from my standpoint, is the court recognized that Mr. White was not aware of those conditions. And I suggest that those conditions are so intrusive that they basically are the functional equivalent of a custodial situation and maybe even worse than a fine. So it's our
position. Mr. Castorano, maybe it's kind of a two-part question that I'm trying to understand your client's argument. It seems like that's counterintuitive then to the law, counters the law. The collateral consequence is one that would not naturally follow, is not anticipated. And you're kind of giving reasons why these would not be anticipated as a collateral consequence. So then I'm wondering, are you arguing, as was the case in Kaiser, that it's a punitive? And in Kaiser, the Supreme Court concluded that the predatory registration law is not punitive. And that seems to have as many or more requirements as does the list of special conditions you just identified. So if it's an issue of punitive, are we still not bound by the Kaiser, if that's your client's argument, versus collateral?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that the predatory registration is a collateral consequence. I would find it hard to believe that anybody would be able to not know that that would be a consequence of his plea of guilty. I would suggest that any good lawyer would let your client know that. These aren't just punitive, Your Honor. These are incredibly intrusive. And I think therein is a big difference. They want to know what Mr. White is doing every minute of the day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And I believe it is our position that these, not all of the special conditions 10 through 21, but certainly some of them, as I have attempted to point out, provide accounting of the vehicle you own or operated as requested. What in the world does that have to do with promoting prostitution? I mean, that's just one of maybe four or five that I believe are not necessarily punitive, but intrusive on his behavior on a day-to-day basis. The second issue, which I think is conceded by the court and supported by the affidavit of trial counsel, is Mr. White wasn't aware of any of these conditions. Now, I would suggest that a trial lawyer would let his client know that you're going to run into some problems with probation, not just because you entered an Alford plea, but because of the charge itself. That's not dispositive, but I think it's something to consider. So it's our position that I understand the Kaiser case. I clearly understand the Alinas case. And I think there's a distinction between being punitive, which is simply, for example, having to register as a predatory offender. I don't consider that necessarily intrusive. That's just a requirement under the law. This isn't a requirement under the law. This is in addition to what we would normally see in any felony sentencing that is so overly intrusive, draconian maybe, onerous for certainly. And I would suggest that that rises to the level then of a direct consequence, and he should be able to withdraw the plea of guilty. I want to mention one final
question. I think myself it's a foolish question, but I'm going back to my trial court days. Isn't there a mechanism that you could, instead of moving to withdraw the guilty plea, is there not an alternative mechanism where you would ask the court to make a determination as to the putative consequences of a condition of probation? And here's what always comes to mind. Somebody's not to leave the state of Minnesota, and then you'd get a request, oh my gosh, my mom died in Florida, I would like to be furloughed, or whatever the situation may have been. Is that not a remedy that's available to your client?
I don't think it is, Judge. At the time of sentencing, the trial attorney representing Mr. White indicated that he was not aware of these, that they were, you know, outside the bounds the court imposed them. I don't know what other, I mean, it's a, for example, if you're placed on probation and you're required to just say, for example, this is a child pornography case, and we would expect that a court would impose a restriction on someone's access to the internet. And I would expect that anybody would expect that, but to then say to the judge, well, I don't want to do that after the court has already imposed these conditions, I just don't see that as an appropriate remedy. Certainly it wasn't pursued by the trial court. I don't see as a remedy that I could have post-conviction that, hey, judge, you imposed these special conditions of probation 10 through 21, and they're really out of bounds, and you need to reconsider. I think that the trial lawyer made reference to that in his at the time of sentencing, but the court went ahead and just literally kind of rubber stamped everything probation provided. So I understand the court's direction with regard to that, but I didn't particularly see post-conviction any purpose or even an avenue in which we could say, hey, judge, you know, this is really intrusive. It's not only overly intrusive, but it's just out of bounds. And will you reconsider?
Well, you can appeal the conditions of probation. There have been such appeals, including, for example, requirement that probationers submit to polygraph testing. That very issue has been appealed. You could have appealed these issues, could you not?
Honestly, Judge, I'm not aware of any avenue in which to appeal a condition of probation subsequent to sentencing other than a petition for post-conviction relief with a motion to withdraw. But I obviously would defer to the court. I'm not aware of any remedy that I could pursue that way. So in summary, we believe it to be overly intrusive, and therefore, as a result of that, a direct consequence. I think what I was going to say was that we had asked for an evidentiary hearing. The court denied that. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that the court given the court's order, should have held an evidentiary hearing, because on page 6 of the order, the court indicated that for the purpose of the memorandum, he presumed as true that the defendant was not aware of the special conditions of probation, which of course would have been the issue in an evidentiary hearing. Beyond that, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll turn to respondent counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Susan DeVos. I'm an assistant Blue Earth County attorney, and I'm here today on behalf of the respondent, State of Minnesota. I am asking the court today to affirm the district court's decision denying Mr. White's petition, post-conviction petition, or what the court interpreted as his post-conviction petition. As this court's aware, the court reviews a district court's denial of a post-conviction petition under an abuse of discretion standard. And a district court abuses that discretion only when its decision is based on an erroneous view of the law or it's against logic in the facts and the record. And there's absolutely no abuse of discretion here. As it appears Mr. White's counsel is conceding that there was no need for an evidentiary hearing here, and that's accurate and true. The district court presumed the evidence in his favor, or presumed the facts in his favor when it made the decision. So it's my understanding that he's no longer raising that as an issue. Mr. White entered into an Alford plea for, and in doing so, acknowledged that through an Alford plea that he was promoting an individual for prostitution. And that plea was entered into in October of 2019. A pre-sentence investigation was ordered, that was completed, and it was filed in February of 2020. Sentencing did not take place until June 30th of 2020. No motions were filed before that to withdraw a plea. In fact, the motion to withdraw the plea was not filed until August 5th of 2020. And again, because this was a motion that was filed after the sentencing, at this point, the only way in which it can be withdrawn is if the motion is timely and if there's a demonstration of manifest injustice. Manifest injustice can only be shown where there's an invalid plea. A valid plea has to be accurate, voluntary, and intelligent. And it appears that Mr. White is only disputing the intelligence factor. The intelligence prong of that's required to be demonstrated requires that a defendant understands the charges against him, the rights that he's waiving, and the consequences of the plea. We're focused totally here on the consequences of the plea, of course. But under the case law and
Ms. DeVos, before you get into that, I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask more of a practical question. I noticed a lot of these specific conditions are qualified by, quote, as requested by probation, end quote. And I didn't see in the record, but maybe it wouldn't be necessarily in the post-conviction relief, but maybe from your experience or from the sentencing, was there any discussion about how often these sorts of things are actually requested by probation, or is it simply a what we might define as a placeholder, so that if ever they do request it, of course, you'd have to be obligated. So do we know, did the court know, the judge know, does that have any relevance perhaps to the issue that we're considering?
Thank you. It's my understanding that everyone was fully aware that Mr. White was planning to move to California or was living in California and would be supervised by an agent in California. The agent here, there is some information in the record here that the agent did a variety of research to determine what sorts of procedures might be necessary to supervise someone under these circumstances. And so wanted to give the probation agent in California as much ability to supervise as possible, but also not knowing exactly what that agent would need. But these were many of the things that they thought could be helpful after doing some research into it and following and tracking Mr. White's activities. And as you indicated, none of them were mandatory on the agent or on Mr. White unless the agent requested them. So it wasn't as, in fact, the way that's been presented by opposing counsel, that they were watching him 24 hours a day, but they could ask for all of this information. And certainly not draconian to be required to provide things such as your telephone numbers. That's just a basic probation. It's necessary for probation to have your telephone numbers so they can keep in touch with you, and also to determine if you've moved, that sort of thing. You just need to keep them updated. So none of these are draconian, certainly, and they were all at the discretion of the probation agent of the conditions that he's disputing. Your Honor, I apologize. It appears, again, that the only thing he's looking at is whether his client understood that these conditions could be in place. Now, certainly he knew as of the time of the pre-sentence investigation was completed that those would be in place. More importantly, he also knew that there was a pre-sentence investigation. The direct consequences were told to him at the time of the plea that was entered into, and those being the maximum sentence, and the possibility of the fine. All of that information was provided to him, but the purpose and intent of a pre-sentence investigation is to determine a number of things, certainly the final recommended sentence, and also things about the defendant. And those things sometimes lead to additional conditions of probation that are recommended by the probation agent. And that's exactly what happened here. These were not direct, they were certainly collateral consequences. And they were, as the court talked about in Kaiser, essentially they were they were more in the lines of public safety and what do we need to do to protect the public rather than punitive. And that's exactly what's happened here. Such as the cars, that information was relevant. This crime stemmed from Mr. White driving a prostitute down to the Mankato area in a certain vehicle, and then he was located by tracking the vehicle. That information would certainly be important for individuals that were trying to find his location or determine what vehicle he was driving. So all of that is relevant. I'm not seeing where any of it's draconian by far. And it's, as the court has indicated, it's not required that a defendant be advised of every possible probation condition. It's not possible to know what all of those are at the time of sentencing, but those direct consequences that everybody would be required or everybody may face or what they need to know at the time of the plea being entered into. So there's no case law to support Mr. White's argument. And it's simply his request that he didn't want to face these consequences. At this point, Your Honor, we are simply asking the court to affirm the district court and find that there is no basis to overturn or to grant his petition for post-conviction relief. And in fact, it was really just a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. But construed as a post-conviction petition, we are asking this court to affirm the district court's decision as it was clearly within the court's discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. DeVos. Mr. Cascarano, you have the last word. You're still muted, sir.
I apologize for that. It would be useless to file a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty before sentence based upon a previous investigation because you don't know what the judge is going to sentence. And so the reference that the trial attorney did not file a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty based upon the recommendations of probation is somewhat curious because just because a probation officer recommends something in the pre-sentence investigation doesn't mean that the court is going to go along with it. That's why the motion to withdraw was filed subsequent to the plea. Clearly, if a pre-sentence investigation recommends, for example, some of these, and the court does not impose what I would consider intrusive and draconian probationary conditions, then we would not necessarily be here. So I don't think a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty prior to sentencing
Okay, I'm not sure I understand that correctly, so I just want to make sure I did. Are you saying then that if a defendant pleads guilty, they shouldn't move to withdraw their guilty plea until they know what the sentence is?
I'm saying that in the event that there is a pre-sentence investigation completed that is recommending to the court, for example, these conditions, at that point, the defendant does not know what the court is going to impose with regard to those conditions. Just because it's recommended doesn't mean the court is going to impose. And in the event that the trial attorney is successful in convincing the judge at the time of sentencing that some of the probationary conditions recommended by probation should not be imposed, then there would be no motion to withdraw the plea of guilty. It is ridiculous to file a motion to withdraw the plea of guilty based upon the grounds that probation is recommending these conditions. That's not a grounds. They have to be imposed by the court. So I suggest that any motion to withdraw the plea of guilty in this particular case, if it's based upon conditions that you expect the court to, or don't know if the court is going to impose, just doesn't make any sense at all. And so I just wanted to bring that to the court's attention. I don't believe the trial attorney did that. And again, we believe that these are, again, I don't want to repeat myself for the eighth time, but intrusive and draconian, and therefore are collateral consequences. I have nothing further beyond that. Thank you.
Are you familiar, Mr. Cascarano, with State versus Franklin from the Minnesota Supreme Court in 2000, where there was an appeal of a probationary condition excluding the defendant from being present in the city of Minneapolis, and that specific condition was concluded by the Supreme Court of Minnesota to be unreasonable and was unnecessary and was therefore stricken?
I'm not familiar with that case, Judge. I guess, are you referencing your earlier question that there was a motion to delete that specific, as opposed to a motion to withdraw the plea, that was an appeal based upon counsel's, that they should not impose that specific condition based upon your earlier question?
Right. It was an appeal of a specific condition, that is the exclusion from the city of Minneapolis as a condition of probation, which the appellant in that case prevailed.
I'm not familiar with it, but I guess based upon that condition of probation, I'm not surprised that they prevailed. That's clearly a direct consequence of a plea. I don't think.
But it's not it isn't a plea withdrawal case. It's an appeal of the reasonableness of the probationary condition itself.
I understand that, Chip. And I know that was your earlier question. I have nothing further.
Thank you, Ms. DeVos, Mr. Cascarano, for appearing on our Zoom platform. The matters are being submitted, which means a decision will be issued within the 90-day statutory timeframe. At this point, we do have non-oral cases that are also submitted today for our consideration. We will stand in recess, a short recess, judges, and then resume for consideration of our other calendar. Thank you. Thank you for appearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.